Good morning, everyone. I'm always amazed to see this many people awake after this many days of DragonCon. I am going to be speaking today on famous unsolved codes. My name is Ilanka Denon, and for those of you that are listening to the recording later on the web, I do have a lot of PowerPoint slides, which I hope will be linked from the website. If not, just go to Google and type in famous unsolved codes, and I should have a link to the slides from there. How many people came to my Cryptos talk on Friday? Wow, okay. Some of the slides you'll be seeing here will be a repeat of that, because when I go over Cryptos, rather than making all new slides, I just reuse the old ones. I'll try and recycle the jokes, but we'll see. So what I'm going to be going over here is various world-famous unsolved codes and some codes that were considered to be unsolvable until they were solved. And I'm going to try and touch on what techniques finally broke them open. How many people here kind of see themselves as cryptographers or hobbyists in some way?
Yeah.
Okay, so for some of you, some of these techniques will be familiar. For others, for who haven't really played with codes, I'll be going over some kind of general techniques. A couple of the codes are quite famous. Edgar Allan Poe was famous for codes. He wrote a cryptography sort of a column in a newsletter in the 1800s for a while, and he actually had a challenge saying, send me a substitution cipher, any substitution cipher, and I will solve it. And the rules he put on it were very, very strict, in such that pretty much anyone could solve them who knew anything about cryptography. But people kept sending in code challenges, and he kept cracking them. So I'll cover a couple of those as well. Who am I? My name is Ilanka, as I said. I am a game developer at the website play.net. We do online multiplayer games. I've been doing this for many, many years. I've been involved with computers for a long time because my father was involved with computers even before I was born. And I've spoken on gaming and cryptography at several different conventions. As a matter of fact, the way I got into codes was here through DragonCon, where I was invited here to originally speak on games, and I was speaking here at the EFF track and met some of the other folks, the SE2600 group, and they provided some code challenges, or they told me about one code challenge that hadn't been cracked in a year of trying, and I took a look at it one weekend and I cracked it in 10 days and won the prize for it, and then went and cracked a bunch of other code challenges and cracked so many that I've actually been forbidden from ever winning any prizes at certain hacker conventions. At the bottom of the page, when they release a code, it says, note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving these codes. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka. So, these are some of the codes that I've cracked. I also did a lot of stuff after September 11th, organized a crisis center, and I've been helping out by teaching government agents about what kind of codes that Al-Qaeda may be using. And I've been invited out to CIA headquarters to speak on codes. I've spoken to Secret Service agents and customs agent, postal inspectors, many different government agencies. And I led the team that cracked one of these famous unsolved codes last year called the Cyrillic Projector, which is connected to another famous unsolved code called Cryptos, which is at the center of CIA headquarters, and I'll go into those as we go along. Also, as I was researching different codes, I learned about several different unsolved ones and decided to make a web page called Famous Unsolved Codes, because no one had really done that in an organized way before. So I corresponded with many world-famous cryptographers, the head of the American Cryptogram Association, and editors of the Cryptologia magazine, and we put together a master list, which is, it's just really took off. I just released it late last year, and it's already had over like 35,000 visitors to it. So it's really sparked some interest there. This is the code, the Freaknik 3 code, that kind of started it all. This is the one that I heard about here at DragonCon. And I just started playing with it. And the way that I cracked it, I'm going to go into a little bit about how these codes got solved, is first I started by just showing it to smart people that I knew. And I said, what do you see here? Do you see any pattern? And most of them would look at it and go, I don't want to solve that. But then they'd say, well, you know, that sort of looks like this, and this sort of looks like that, and then they'd go off and do their own thing. And I would take whatever ideas that they had thrown out, and then I would start playing with them. And someone might say, that looks like hexadecimal, or that looks sort of like a UU encoding header, or that sort of looks like actually no one looked at it and said that looked like binary. But and then I would go to Google, and I'd research these things, and I'd find out more about them, and then I'd just keep playing with it and keep playing with it. Sometimes I would literally, I'd go to the closet and I'd take out a Scrabble set and I would just dump all the Scrabble tiles on the table and start moving things around and just trying to see if any patterns showed up, anything that might spark an idea. And it worked because I cracked it. So, and then after I cracked it, I wrote this tutorial about how I'd done it, and it's written in a very tongue-in-cheek cyberpunk fashion. There's a lot of in-jokes there, ranging from Monty Python to Illuminatus Trilogy, The Matrix. It's all mixed in there, so if you enjoy reading that kind of thing, it's a fun read. And through the Freaknik 3 code, again, coming back to DragonCon, I heard about the crypto sculpture here. This is at the center of CIA headquarters. This sculpture is about 12 feet tall, and it's actually transparent. You can actually see through it. Are these showing up okay? Do we want to turn off the lights here? Is that better? Okay. So these letters are actually punched through the sculpture, and so you're actually seeing the building and the shrubberies on the other side of it. And there's about 2,000 characters on this sculpture, and there's four codes. The sculpture was installed in 1990, and three of those four codes have been solved. The fourth one has never been solved, and it is one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. It was on my quest to find out how famous it was, because I was getting written up in newspapers for the Cyrillic Projector, and they were saying, how famous is Kryptos? And I went around asking people, saying, is there a list of famous unsolved codes? And they said, no, so okay, I'll make a list. And then I could answer the reporters when they asked me, how famous is Kryptos? And what I came up with was that Kryptos was about at number 5 on the top 10 list of unsolved codes. I'm going to be covering a few of these. I won't be covering all of them. Is there anyone in the room that's like really curious about any particular code on this list?
I read something recently about the Voynich manuscript. Someone came out with a very interesting theory, and it seems to be widely accepted that it's gibberish. Somebody used a template, just copied garbage.
Okay.
And that's what it is. And he's somehow been able to prove that it is in fact garbage.
Okay.
What do you think?
I'm repeating this for the recording. The Voynich manuscript, which is number 2 on my list, has been in the news quite a bit lately. It was written up in the Wired magazine, it was written up in Scientific American, it was on Slashdot, and I will be covering that. And someone has come up and said, I have solved Voynich, and he's saying that he's solved it by proving that it was a hoax, and I'm going to be going over my opinion on that, which may not entirely agree with his opinion. But however, I do believe it is true that many of these that some of these unsolved codes are still unsolved because they were hoaxes, and they never will be solvable. However, they continue to spark the imagination, and for that, they serve a good purpose because they get people learning about codes. I see a hand up in the back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The unsolved World War II systems.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
or just that there are some that don't actually have access to the information to try and play around with them.
Okay, we'll go through the other stuff, and then at the end, I have this same slide at the end, and if we, however much time we have, we'll go over those. Cool. Any others that anyone's really curious about? I see a hand behind the projector. The question was about Edgar Allan Poe, and
yeah.
Yes, Edgar Allan Poe had two challenge ciphers that he published when he finished writing his newsletter, and he said, here are two more challenge ciphers which were written by the well-respected Mr. Tyler, and then Poe went on and lived out the rest of his life, and those challenge ciphers stayed unsolved for over 100 years. However, they have both been cracked. One was cracked in 1992, and the other was cracked in 2000, and I'll go over how they were cracked and what they say later on in the talk. So, but yeah, good question. Poe had some very, very famous unsolved codes. Any others? Okay. So this is just a quickie screenshot of my webpage. I have the URL later on in the presentation. Just go to Google and type in famous unsolved codes. This is currently the number one link there. It really hit the blogosphere about 2 months ago. I tracked the hits to my site, and the hits just quintupled. And it was because someone in one of the blog link tracking sites had linked it and said, this is a popular link. And then the people started linking it because it was a popular link. And it got this amazing feedback circle going on. So now this is not the most famous of the unsolved codes, but it's definitely in the top 10 list. And I include it first because it's short and it's simple, and it kind of gives you an idea of what we're dealing with. This was written by the composer, Edward Elgar. He did the pomp and circumstance theme whenever there's a graduation ceremony. The pomp and circumstance. And he enjoyed studying codes. And he had a friend, a young woman, Miss Dora Penny, who was not a cryptographer. She was not a mathematician. She was just a friend, and they would spend many hours talking about music and whatever other things they talked about in that day. And he had sent a letter to someone associated with her, her mother or a relative. And on at the bottom of the letter, the back of the envelope, if anyone remembers the exact details, please feel free to speak up. And he included a separate message to Miss Penny. And this is the entirety of the message. And she never cracked it. She never solved it. And in her later on in her life, when she wrote her memoirs, and she included a picture of this, and she said, I would be most grateful if someone could tell me whatever it said. She did speak to Edward about it and asked him what it said. And he said, with all we've talked about, I'm surprised you never solved it. And it looks simple enough. It looks like a little substitution cipher. So maybe it referred to something personal between them. Maybe he mentioned some code technique that he thought she would remember that she didn't, or maybe he forgot, or maybe he just messed up. Quite often, code makers do make mistakes. And I have, in playing with codes myself, I'll encrypt something, and then I'll go back and try to solve what I just encrypted, and I'll get completely lost, and I'll realize that I made some mistake. I shifted things over by a column when I shouldn't have, which is why it's always important to test whatever you do. I've met many young cryptographers, teenagers, who get really excited about this, and they decide they want to write a code, and then they send me the code and say, crack this code. And the first thing I always ask them is, have you tested it? Have you given this code to anyone else who has solved it? And most often they say no, and they say, can't you solve it? And I'm like, well, and then I tell them to talk me through how they created it. And the majority of the time, they are unable to solve their own codes because they didn't understand the process well enough in order to put a code together in a good way. Now here's another famous unsolved code. This was a serial killer back in the 60s and early 70s, and he killed several people, and he would leave messages, and he'd send these encrypted messages to the newspapers, and he enjoyed taunting the police. And in some of the messages he would say, if you can solve this message, it says who I am. Now some of those messages have since been solved, and they didn't have his name or anything like that. However, the killer was never caught. There are suspicions about who it was, there's a really good website out there called ZodiacKiller.com, which includes pretty much everything that's known about him, including suspicions about who we think the killer might be. And they've also got transcripts of all of the messages and the deciphered text of several of the messages. I've never gone in and actually solved any of these myself. However, to the best of my understanding, they're basically substitution ciphers, which is where each symbol is representing a different letter. Then there's the Beale ciphers. This is the number one on my list. How many people here have heard of the Beale ciphers before? Right. It is, how many people have actually played with it? Did you ever come up with anything interesting?
I just played around with simple phrases and
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein to create and then crack it myself.
Okay, and did you come up with any interesting patterns?
Not anything that I noticed. I just was able to get back what I put into it.
Okay, all right. Many, many people have played with this. Much, much money has been spent on this. In a nutshell, what happened was that I have some more slides here. But in 1885, a pamphlet was published in Bedford, Virginia, and the pamphlet was about 20 pages long, and it included three encrypted messages and a very interesting story. And the story was that about 60 years before that someone had come to Bedford, Virginia with three wagons full of treasure, gold and gems, and had buried them in some location near Bedford. And that the location of the treasure was included in one of the encrypted messages. So there were three encrypted messages, and this was one of them. And it's basically a long series of numbers, and it said the locality of the vault. And then the second one, this was the contents of the vault, again a long series of numbers. Now, according to the pamphlet, the man who had come to Virginia had buried the gold and then had left these messages with a local innkeeper, with instructions that if the man who buried the gold did not return in 10 years, then the innkeeper was to open this box and take the messages and would receive a code key in the mail, which he could use to decrypt these messages. Again, this is all according to the pamphlet. Well, I think more than 10 years go by, maybe 15 or 20 years go by, nothing's heard from the man who buried the gold, and so the innkeeper finally opens the box and he sees these messages, plays with them for the rest of his life, makes no progress, at the end of his life gives them to a younger friend. Again, this is all according to the pamphlet. The younger friend plays with the messages for a long time, and then he figures out how to solve this one, paper number 2, which says the gold and the gems that are buried. Then he continues playing with it for several years, says, I can't get any further, so I'm going to publish everything I know about it in this pamphlet. I'm not going to put my name on the pamphlet. This is an anonymous pamphlet. And I'm going to give this pamphlet to a trusted friend named Mr. Ward, and Mr. Ward is going to publish the pamphlet. Don't contact me. I don't know anything more than what's in this pamphlet. So the pamphlet sold quite well in Bedford, Virginia. It was 50 cents per pamphlet, and much effort has gone into solving the messages. Now, according to the pamphlet, this is how number 2 came apart. It used what's called a book code, as the gentleman in the back mentioned. He was using Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. According to the pamphlet, number 2 was used a code that used the Declaration of Independence, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. Now, if you take the Declaration of Independence and you number each word, and then you go to the paper number 2, which starts out with 115, 73, 24, 807. So word number 115 here is the word instituted, and you take the first letter of that, which is an I, and then you go to word number 73, which is hold, and the first letter of that is an H. 24, the word is another, the first letter is an A, and so you can spell something out. You get the words I have, and you keep doing that with all of the numbers from paper number 2, and you get an entire message. I have deposited in the county of Bedford, about 4 miles from Buford's, in an excavation or vault 6 feet below the surface of the ground, the following articles, belonging jointly to the parties whose names are given in number 3 herewith. The first deposit consisted of 1,014 pounds of gold and 3,812 pounds of silver, deposited November 1819. The second was made December 1821 and consisted of 1,907 pounds of gold and 1,288 pounds of silver, also jewels, obtained in St. Louis in exchange for silver to save transportation and valued at $13,000. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault is roughly lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone and are covered with others. Paper number 1 describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it. So, and then it goes on to paper number 3, names and residences, which is again a long series of numbers. So, is this a real treasure or is it a hoax? Many people have done a lot of research on this pamphlet, since pretty much everything comes from that pamphlet. Yes, there were individuals by the name of Mr. Morris of the innkeeper. Though many people have raised questions saying, okay, somebody got a bunch of gold in the West and then took 3 wagons full of it all the way back east to Virginia to bury it in some town that he didn't know and then leave a message with some innkeeper that he didn't know saying where the gold, and it just kind of sounds kind of off. Also in the pamphlet he talked about how they went into the West and they saw a stampede and that led them to some place where they found the gold. And somebody pointed out that the word stampede was not really in use in the English language until about 50 years after supposedly this pamphlet was written, which might or might not be valid, because sometimes words are in use in the language verbally even if they aren't written. Jim Gologli, who was the head of the American Cryptogram Association, he feels that he's debunked it, because he ran the other papers, 1 and 3, against the Declaration of Independence and found that though he wasn't getting English text out of it, he did get the entire alphabet. There was a place where it's basically like A A B B C C D D F G H H J J K K, and it's an obvious pattern, though it's not the exact alphabet. And when I look at that, I think that if I were going to make an urban legend or a hoax of this kind, and I was going to take a code and I was just going to kind of sloppily put a bunch of numbers together, I'd probably get really bored about halfway through, and I'd probably start doing things like that and start, okay, I'll sort of do the alphabet here and no one will ever notice. And But other people say, aha, but the fact that we found the alphabet is proof that there is a pattern there, and maybe it's a double encrypted message or a triple encrypted message. Holes have been dug all over the Bedford, Virginia countryside. And there are many people who say that they've solved it, and they publish books on it. And these books sell quite well, and I've gotten one or two of these books, and they say, ah, we've solved it, and the key is this, and they say it's 42 or 73. And there's no duplicatable method. They say, well, I don't want to give too much information. And I think, okay, I think the original thing was an urban legend, and I think their current book is an urban legend, and that there's just a lot of people in that area that are finding ways to make money off the gullible. However, it may be solvable, and if nothing else, the hunt is worth it. Some people have said that maybe the pamphlet was written as something for the Masons. The Masons say a lot of mysterious stuff. But one of their key tenets is that the search can often be more important than what has been found. And there was even a fable about, and I won't read the entire thing, but how there was a farmer who was dying, and he had a vineyard, and he was worried that his sons would not take care of the vineyard after he died. And so what he did before he died is he told his sons that there was a treasure in the vineyard, and they would have to go find it. And after he died, his sons went and they just dug the heck out of the vineyard looking for that treasure. They never found a treasure, but by turning the earth in the vineyard, they kept the vineyard healthy. And so the vineyard continued to provide a good crop, and the family was able to prosper because of that. And it's possible that's why the pamphlet was published, as a way of encouraging people to search, to hunt, to play with things, to learn about codes, and it might just be for the quest of knowledge. Okay, here's another interesting sort of unsolved code. There was a code associated with it, which was solved, but the deep mystery has never really been solved. This is called the Money Pit, also called the Oak Island. This is off the coast of Nova Scotia, I think. And in 1795, there was a teenager exploring one of the islands, and he found a very deep pit. And at some point, there was intriguing. I think there was a tree over it with a rope around the tree and a block and tackle leading down into the pit. And they went back later to kind of explore it more, and they found about 10 feet down, they found a barrier of logs. And they kept digging, and about another 10 feet down, they found another barrier that had like coconut fibers. And they kept digging, and they found another barrier. And they kept digging and digging and digging. And as you can see, it's an island, and so the water table is rather high on it. And they'd get to a certain point, and the water would rush in and would collapse the tunnel. And so they would dig some more, and then that tunnel would get collapsed. And millions of dollars have been spent on this island, very well-financed expeditions to try and find out what's at the bottom of this pit. And the pit has absorbed millions of dollars of effort. And much money has also been raised in order to keep digging. And in the 1850s, during one of these fundraising drives, a mysterious stone with a code on it supposedly emerged from this pit. And here's sort of some there's many, many diagrams like this out on the web, showing the various layers. And supposedly in the early 1990s, I think a camera was lowered into this pit, and they said that they thought they saw pictures of a chest and maybe a human body. And people have actually died trying to get to the bottom of this, because the water keeps coming in and collapsing the tunnels, and people are drowning in the tunnels. And it's just amazing the amount of effort that's gone into it. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute did a survey on it, very extensive analysis, and they said they looked at these videos and they didn't see anything that looked like a chest, and they didn't see anything that looked like a body, and they didn't see anything that looked like a severed human hand. However, it is definitely unstable ground in that area. The stone that was found, supposedly the stone was found at about here, right about at this level. And the stone, of course, has been lost to the ages. The stone no longer exists. However, during the fundraising drive, they said this stone had this message on it. It came out to be a simple substitution cipher, and it said, 40 feet below, 2 million pounds are buried. And you know, some people have said that this was done by the Knights Templar, and that maybe the Holy Grail is down at the bottom of this pit. And you can hear the skepticism in my voice on this. And the idea that there would be an English message encrypted there, when they were trying to hide a treasure, that there's a stone there saying that there's a treasure buried. Maybe not. But this was a very famous code for a while. It didn't take long to crack. I think they cracked it in like 15 minutes. But for the investors who didn't know any better, I could see people reaching into their pockets to be coming up with more money. Then there's the Voynich manuscript. This is the one that's been in the news lately. And it's about, it's at least 400 years old. It has been traced very, very thoroughly. It resurfaced in the early 1900s, and an antique book dealer found it. And it's been traced back to Emperor Rudolf, who spent about 800 gold ducats to purchase this thing, which is worth about $30,000 in today's money. And it's got wonderful diagrams all through it of strange plants that do not really exist. And this wonderful script all through it, very, very beautiful script that is unlike any other language or any other alphabet in existence. If we were to transcribe some of these characters into letters that we would understand, it has a sort of a repeating pattern like this. This is not an exact pronunciation of any one page of the Voynich, but you can sort of see that words tend to start with the same thing and sort of tend to end with the same thing. And there's hundreds and hundreds of pages like this with very beautiful diagrams on them. So was this a real code, or again, was it a hoax? Well, the Emperor Rudolf was known to shell out big money for curiosities. And it's possible that someone knew this and decided to make a curiosity to extract as much gold as possible from his emperorship. Or it might be a code. It might be some language that, I don't know. My gut says that it's a hoax. Now, in the news recently, someone else has come forward and said, I have proven, in fact, he hasn't said that he's proven it. He says he's solved Voynich, and he's saying that he solved Voynich by proving that it's a hoax. So what he's talking about is a system called the card and grill. And the way that this works is that you have some cardstock with holes cut in it, and that you would have a larger grid of symbols or syllables, and that you would move this card so that it would cover most of the grid and maybe only show three or four of the locations. And then you would take those and you would make a word out of them. So you could go through and make things that sort of look like words in a very elegant fashion. They would have a certain structure. Now, it's a plausible idea. However, I've talked to the cryptographers who are working on Voynich, and they say, yes, it's a plausible idea, but it has not been used to recreate any part of Voynich. It's just an idea, it's just a hypothesis. And there's over 200 pages of the manuscript, and none of it has been duplicated at this point. So until some portion of it is duplicated, I'm not going to sign off on it and say this is the method that was used to create Voynich, except to say that I too think that it's probably a hoax. I can't prove it, I'm just going on gut instinct there. Any other questions on Voynich? Does that answer the questions about what's in the news? Okay. So then there's the Edgar Allan Poe challenge ciphers. This was cipher number 2, as a matter of fact. And when Poe was signing off of his newsletter, he said, here are 2 more challenges for you. And they were not solved in his lifetime, but they were solved relatively recently. And this was cipher number 1. And I won't read it, but it's basically a line from a play, a 1713 play. And the way that it came apart, as I understand it, is that it was a substitution cipher. And what someone noticed is that you have this pattern here where you have like a comma and then a dagger symbol and then the section symbol. And someone noticed that 3-character pattern repeated in other locations. Over here we have it again, the comma, dagger, section symbol. And the most commonly used word in the English alphabet is the word the. And they started with the premise that maybe that stood for the, and they played with it, and it came apart. So finding a small clue like that in a cryptographer terms, we'll also call it a crib, may be what makes the whole thing come apart. And here's cipher number 2. I don't know which technique it was that made it come apart. This was done with a polyalphabetic substitution cipher, which meant that there were multiple letters that could all stand for the same English letter. But again, it was an English thing. And interestingly enough, when it was finally solved, there were many, many errors. There was about 2 dozen errors that were in this cipher. And as you can see, they went to great effort to try and make upside down letters and lowercase and uppercase. And while doing that, they introduced several errors. They meant to put in an uppercase W, and they should have put in a lowercase W. So a complex code is, if it's hard for someone to solve, it's probably also going to be hard for someone to make. Now this is probably the oldest one on the list. This is called the Phaistos disk, and this is from about 1800 BC. It's got several different symbols stamped. The disk itself is about 6 inches wide. It was discovered in Crete, and there's several old languages that we still don't know how to read. So some people have suggested that this might be a Rosetta Stone for solving one of those languages, because it was discovered near other tablets that had a language called Linear A, and Linear A is one of the more famous unsolved languages. And 241 signs on it. And there are some people who have said, oh, I've solved it, and it's instructions for a religious ceremony. And it may well be, but I would want more backup on that before I would accept a solution like that. And now my favorite code to talk about, which is Kryptos. And this is the one in CIA headquarters. And it's this is part 4, which has not yet been solved. And some of these slides are from my previous Kryptos talk, so I'm going to be kind of skipping through them kind of fast. Kryptos was made by a man named James Sanborn, who was born in 1945. And the first three parts were solved by a CIA analyst named David Stein, and also by Jim Galogli, who I mentioned before is the head of the American Cryptogram Association. Jim is also the man who feels that he's debunked the Voynich manuscript, and he solved many other historical codes. He debunked the Beale ciphers. He has worked on the Voynich manuscript, and he maintains one of the primary Voynich websites. And it was Jim that I wrote to about 2 days ago, and I asked him about the card and grill system, and I said, has anyone duplicated the method? And he said, no one's duplicated any part of the manuscript yet. So while researching Kryptos and researching the other sculptures that James Sanborn made, I found out that Sanborn, after he made the CIA version of Kryptos, he also made a smaller version called the Untitled Kryptos piece, which he sold to a private collector. And on that, there's two sides of it, and one side is all in English text, and the other side is in Russian. And we decided to take a look at this Russian side to see if maybe solving the code on this side might help us solve the side on the English the text on the English side, which is the Kryptos section. And the Russian was also, that was on the untitled piece, was also placed on this one, which is called the Cyrillic projector. And this is the one that we cracked last year. Just some interesting visuals here about when looking at the untitled piece, there were some differences on the untitled piece between the text that's there and the text that's on Kryptos. Some dots that we found. And again, this is the CIA's version. And this, taking Kryptos apart a little more, we have a visionaire table on one side here, where we have a reference alphabet coming down the edge here and a reference alphabet coming across the top. And the way that a visionaire table is put together is that you take a keyword and then you make a cipher alphabet. So we have the 26 letters of the alphabet, and then you take out the keyword, and I have a little animation on how that works. My first ever flash animation. So you take out all the letters of the keyword, and then you pile up the rest of the letters in the alphabet after it. And that's how you make a cipher alphabet that uses that particular keyword. And then if you line it up with a single keyword, you've got the keyword along the top here, which is Kryptos. And then if you also read down the left-hand column, you've also got the word Kryptos here. Now, you could make it a more secure cipher by using one keyword for the cipher alphabet and then a different keyword coming down the left-hand margin. And that's what was done for the first part of Kryptos. So the first part is these top two lines. And then you set up your tableau here, where the first keyword is Kryptos, and the second one is the word palimpsest. Palimpsest is a word that means a scroll that has had one message scraped off, and then another message could be written on the scroll, and then bits of the first message might be showing through. So you take the ciphertext, which is EMUFP, and then you each letter is on a different line, and then you trace up. So the E goes to a B, the M to an E, the U to a T, the F to a W. So E, M, U, F, P, H, Z would come out to the word between. So part one, using Kryptos and Palimpsest, comes out to say between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. And there's a typo here. And it might have been an error. However, we've gone back to the artist. I've had dinner with Jim Sanborn, and I said, hey, did you screw up, or was this deliberate? And he said that it wasn't a screw up, but he says it's not what the typo is that's so important as where it is, its orientation or its positioning. Now, part two starts here at line three, goes all the way down to the bottom of this panel, and this is the ciphertext. And I've highlighted here DQM, because this is what made the thing come apart. David Stein, for him, Jim Galoglia did it with a computer attack, but David Stein did it with pencil and paper. And what he noticed was that we had these three characters that were the same, and they were at what's called a period of seven. So, which means that if you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or was it 8? Was it 1, 2, 3? Yeah, 7. So the D, 8. Okay, what it was is that he made the intuitive leap that DQM stood for the word the, and that's why it was repeating. Now, as it turned out, it's a period of 8 and not 7, is because instead of being the, it was actually they. And what that section came out to be, using the keywords of Kryptos and Apsista, was the DQM was here, the and they, and the and Earths. And I'll read this for those in the back who can't see it. Part 2 came out to say, it was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose, or maybe ID by Roe S. And since I know there's a cryptographer in the audience here, John Wilson, who's worked a lot on this, and he says the X's may be important, so I have to, yeah, don't forget the X's.
What about the spelling of underground?
No, and the question was about the misspelling in underground. That is another typo that is hard-coded into the sculpture itself. And again, Sanborn said about that it is deliberate and that it's not what it is so important as where it is, or its orientation or its positioning. One theory is that the code may have been written without typos, and then he laid another message on top of the ciphertext. So we look at what letters resulted in occlusion and underground. And to make a Q in that location in the word illusion, there's the ciphertext letter of a K. To make a U in underground at that location is a ciphertext letter of an R. So it's possibly spelling out the word Kryptos. Maybe it might be a coincidence. We don't know. I say I don't know a lot because we don't know for sure. There's just a lot of really interesting phenomena here. The X's are used. Sometimes they seem to be separating sentences, sometimes not. Maybe they're part of the code, maybe they're a clue, maybe they're just filler. Whenever a code maker is making a code, and sometimes you need to put things into a certain grid format. And so the way they'll do that is they'll take a worksheet and they'll write out the message onto the worksheet. And if they end up with extra boxes on the worksheet that need to be filled in, they'll usually fill them in with X's or Q's. And so often when you're solving a code and you come up with those things, it's because that's where they showed up on the worksheet. The latitude and longitude, I'll go into that in more detail in a few slides from now. The 6.5 seconds north is of particular interest because anyone here that's played with a GPS or has done geocaching knows that a tenth of a second of latitude is a very, very specific location, about 10 feet across. And it does point to the general location of the crypto sculpture at CIA headquarters, but not the exact location. It points to an area about 150 feet southeast of the sculpture. Now, also something that it's been pointed out, it may or may not be true, is that the sentence between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion may be a clue for the key word of part two. Sanborn has said that this is a sentence that he wrote himself. He says it's an originally written sentence with very specifically chosen wording. I'm not sure if that's exactly how he said it, but it's pretty close. And someone has pointed out that it might be like a cryptic crossword clue, where between subtle shading, where you have the SS, and the absence, ABS, of light, C, so you have the ABS and the C and the SS, that maybe this sentence is a memory jogger for someone in the future if they forget the key word. I've also talked to Ed Scheidt, who is the head of the CIA's Cryptographic Center. Ed Scheidt is the one who taught Sanborn about codes, and Scheidt said that he specifically designed the code systems in Kryptos to have many different ways of being solved. He said he wanted to have many different keys so that he could give different keys to different people and they'd all be able to solve it. He also said something interesting, Ed did, that he designed it in such a way that the code could be solved without someone knowing that it had been solved. And we don't know what that means. And he may have been, this guy used to be a CIA op, so he may have just been tossing a lot of misdirection into the mix. Someone else recently also pointed out that in abscissa are the letters CIA, which again may or may not be useful or interesting. Well, it is interesting, but we don't know if it actually has anything to do with the code. Part three starts here at the top of this plate and goes all the way down to about here, to about four rows from the bottom. Also notice, if you can see this from the back, there's a few letters that are out of alignment here, and I'll cover those a bit more later. So here we have the part three ciphertext. Now anyone who's played with codes is going to immediately notice certain patterns here, and they're going to see that it matches an English frequency analysis. You have a lot of E's, you have a lot of T's, you have a lot of A's. So rather than being a substitution cipher, you have all the letters of the message. It's plausible that you have all the letters of the message here, and they just need to be rearranged. So one way to rearrange them, this is a method that I came up with, is that if you take all of them and you put them into rows of this length, and it comes out to a nice even box, and that comes back to what I was saying about the worksheet format, that maybe this is the way that it was encrypted. And here we have the letter S. Remember the first part which said ID by rows or ID by row S, which may or may not be a clue. And then if you make diagonals, basically you're counting down by four. S, 1, 2, 3, 4, you get an L. You get an O, W, L, Y, you get the word slowly, slowly, desperately. And if you keep doing that all the way through and then start over at this side and work all your way through, you can just zip out the entire message with this technique. Slowly, desperately. And what that comes out to say is, slowly, desperately, slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. So again, we have only one X in this message, whereas the previous message had several X's. Is it filler? Could it mean something? We don't know. The Q, why is the Q there? Is the Q standing for a question mark? Is it filler? We don't know. There's a lot of interesting theories about it, however.
And the question mark is a question mark.
Is there is a question mark on the sculpture, and part four starts with part four starts with a question mark. So that question mark at the beginning of part four might be the end of part three, or it might be the beginning of part four. We don't know, but it's there. So that's why you'll see part four, I write about it and I say it's either 97 or 98 characters. And the reason we don't know is because we don't know which part that question mark is. Now the text that I read, the slowly, desperately, slowly, some of you may have recognized that as from if you've studied history or archaeology. When King Tut's tomb was discovered, it was discovered by an archaeologist named Howard Carter. And it's a paraphrased extract from Howard Carter's diary. And the date was November 26, 1922. And his answer to "Can you see anything?" He's written several different accounts of it, and he's said his answer was multiple different things, either "yes, wonderful things" or "yes, it is wonderful." I've been trying to get my hands on an exact a photocopy of his diary from that day. I know it's in the Oxford University archives. I've been unable to do that. If anyone here has contacts at Oxford University that can maybe get their hands on a photocopy of that page, I would very much appreciate talking to you. So then we come back to part four. Now the Cyrillic projector. The Cyrillic projector, again, so we have the CIA's crypto sculpture. The text on it is also duplicated on another sculpture called the Untitled Cryptos piece, which has English text on one side, Russian on the other. That Russian text was also on the Cyrillic projector, which was used for Sanborn's gallery shows in the 1990s and then was installed at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte in about 1997. And we started taking a look at it last year because someone named Randall Bolig went through and took a bunch of pictures of it and said, let's see if we can get this thing solved. and we did solve it. And it basically, the process basically broke down into three steps: transcription, decryption, and translation. The hardest thing was getting the thing transcribed. Randall started it by getting the pictures taken, and then I made those pictures available to our cryptography group, and nothing was really done on it for a few weeks, so I decided, okay, I'll start transcribing it. I spent 2 weeks transcribing it from pictures, presented my transcript to the group, at which point two other people said, hey, we've got transcripts too. At first I was very annoyed, but then it was also a good thing because we now had three entirely independent transcripts which we could use to compare to make sure that the transcript that we were using was really a very accurate transcript. And we played with it for a while. I wasn't really seriously playing with it. I had other projects I was working on. But no one really came up with anything, so I said, okay, let's go ahead and post it on the web. Let's post it to the world, see if anybody can come up with anything. And somebody did come up with something, because in July I got this strange anonymous letter that was sent to me saying, I have solved the Cyrillic projector. It wasn't that hard. I'm not going to tell you what it said, though, because I have a sense of humor. And I'm like, okay, what do I do with this? Does this person get credit for it? Do they not get credit for it? And I talked to Jim Gologli about it, and he said that the general accepted wisdom is that an anonymous solver does not get credit. That to get credit, you have to not only say that you solved something, but you have to prove how you solved it, and you have to provide a method so that other people can duplicate what you've done, and that's basic science. Someone cannot say they've made a scientific discovery unless they can publish enough about it that other independent laboratories can duplicate it. So he didn't get credit for it, though I am mentioning him in my talk. So, and then in September, the same guy who sent me the anonymous letter decided to make a web page, and he wanted to give me another hint, but what he didn't know was that the second he made the web page and included a link to my site, I knew about it because I read my web logs every day, and if traffic's not particularly high, I'll go tracing back to see who's linking to me. And I found this URL linking to me, which was cpsolution.htm, and I thought, wow, that's a real interesting URL. And I went and followed it back, and I found this web page, which didn't have the plain text, but it did have a visionaire table. I recognized it immediately, though it was a visionaire table in Russian. And the alphabet was in a different order. I'll point out here, anyone here read Russian? Okay. The alphabet, of course, is in a different order than the English alphabet. And there's these two characters here where you see this one that looks like a fork, and this one with a fork with a tail. And this is the sh sound, and this is the sh ch sound. And they're normally like that in the alphabet, where they're sequential. However, in the cipher alphabet that the projector used, they were not sequential. The sh was here, and the sh ch was here, and there were other characters that were in the middle. And that was one of the things that made it harder to solve. And there was a twist partway through where the system switched halfway through. So the man who solved it, Frank Corr from North Carolina, he gets credit for wading through these things. We don't know if these were errors in the encryption process or whether it was deliberately done. My guess is that they were errors, that the person who made this code, whether it was Sanborn or whether it was one of assistants, didn't know that much about Russian and probably made some mistakes.
Only WW knows.
Only WW knows. So anyway, we traced this back. I duplicated this table once I saw this alphabet system. And then I found out later that Frank had figured out this out, but he still didn't know what the code said, because he got sort of a mass of text that had some Russian words in it, but he couldn't read Russian, and there was a lot of spelling errors. And so he was still a step away from solving the code. Well, after I saw this table and I duplicated this method, and this was on a Friday evening, and then I got to the same point that he'd been at, which was having a massive Russian text where I could sort of pick out some words and couldn't really read it, and went to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, woke up the next morning, and then had this huge ethical dilemma in me, because on the one hand I wanted to keep working on solving this code, and on the other I'd promised some friends that I would help them move. So I had this thing about, okay, carrying boxes, work on famous international code, back and forth, okay, and I decided to try and do both. And it was a very dramatic and interesting day where I was carrying boxes and working a cell phone and putting down a box and going out in the front yard and trying to get a signal and calling people desperately, trying to find someone who spoke Russian. And finally found someone who spoke Russian. It was a friend of a friend of my father, who used to be, the friend of a friend used to be an engineer in the ex-Soviet Union. So I'd call my father, and I had posted my version of the Russian text online, So my father could see it, and he sent it to his Russian friend, and back and forth, and cell phones and boxes. And by the end of the day, my friends were mostly moved, and we'd cracked this big famous international code. And I went and I shared the information with the rest of my Kryptos group, and it was duplicated, and it was verified, and then we did a press release, and then all hell broke loose. So this is what I came up with on Friday evening. And if there was anyone here who could read Russian, they'd confirm that there's some sort of stuff in there. To give you an English example of the problem, this sentence might be easily understandable to a native English speaker, but someone not familiar with English would have a great deal of trouble reading or translating it. Plus the fact that there isn't any punctuation isn't any help either. So you can see that a native speaker would have a lot of trouble with this, and we had a whole lot of trouble with that. But with a native speaker, it came right apart, and he broke it up into words, and he made some wonderful charts and diagrams Anatoly did for me. And we had confirmed this by Saturday, September 20th, and then we released it on Slashdot. And I won't read this entire thing, but it came out to be two different sections from classified KGB correspondence. One was instructions to Secret Service agents about how to obtain a source and how you want to weave a psychological net around that source so that you can pull the net tight to manipulate them at the proper time, saying that if you can control a source of information, then you know that you can trust the information that you are getting from that source. So I love this sentence at the end, which says, however, the methods and behavioral techniques that are needed to attain this goal are radically contrary to the ethics and morality of society in the field of interpersonal relations. Yeah. Okay. And then part two of the code was, it seemed to be an extract from an internal KGB memo where they were talking about Sakharov, the Soviet dissident Sakharov, and concerns that they had that statements by Sakharov were going to be used by the Americans for an anti-Soviet agenda. And it truncates very suddenly here at the end. And what we did is we went back to the original piece, the untitled Kryptos piece, which had some additional encrypted text. And sure enough, it continues without a break. So we did compare this to the Antipodes, which is at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., if you ever want to go take a look at it. It's similar to the version that's in the private collector. And it just continues right on. And you can say, I know what that says now. And when we did our press release, and we said that it was extracts from classified KGB correspondence. Well, how do we know it was classified KGB correspondence? Well, because we found one of the source documents. And this is the subject line of this, and again, if there were someone here who spoke Russian, but I will say that this says Sakharov here, and that's kind of one way that you can see. And that's basically, it came from the subject line of this letter and then continued right into the first paragraph. I think Antipodes, the untitled piece, goes about this far down the document. And we knew that it was classified because it said so up at the top. It said Sekretno. And this document was smuggled out of the Soviet Union in about 1990, and copies of it are being maintained at the Library of Congress. James Sanborn's father worked at the Library of Congress for 30 years. He was an archivist there. So that's, we believe, how Sanborn had access to some of these documents. So you're saying that the text goes all the way to the second page of the memo? Okay, that's John Wilson saying that he thinks the text goes further in the source document. Okay. And then after the press release went out, how many people here have heard of Slashdot, the website? Okay, most of the people here. It's a high-tech news site that anything kind of interesting in the crypto tech scene shows up and then immediately crashes the site that is being linked to from all of the hits that come in from it. And my site did not crash. However, I was tracking my web hits, and it was like 5 hits an hour, 8, 12 hits an hour, 9,037. Went boom. And I got just tens of thousands of hits over the course of about 48 hours. And then there was a lot of chatter on Slashdot. And the forums there are very high energy, exuberant, irreverent. And I got a good laugh out of some of them. I'll share some of this. They said, okay, well, that's nice, but what the Cyrillic projector really says is, send more vodka. But my favorite of the ones is that what the Cyrillic projector really says is, keep information away from moose and squirrel. So we've gone back, and there were several typos. in the Russian text, and we've gone back and we've compared them against the Cyrillic projector to see if was our transcript an error, or could these errors possibly be giving us a clue for solving cryptos, or were they just screw-ups? And our transcript was accurate. Some of the places it looks like, and I don't know if you can see this here, there's two characters called the E and the E, and one is a backwards I and one is a backwards I with a little squiggle over it. And some of the typos were like that. It should have been an E and it was an I. And it strikes me that it probably was just an error in the creation process. One of Sanborn's assistants who didn't kind of proofread as carefully as they could have. But other letters are completely different. I didn't ask Sanborn if the projector has anything to do with cryptos, because I didn't think he'd answer. But I asked Ed Scheidt if he had anything to do with the creation of the Cyrillic projector, because he helped Sanborn with cryptos. And Scheidt said no. So I find that very interesting, because if Scheidt would have said that yes, he had something to do with the Cyrillic projector, then maybe the Cyrillic projector would be giving us clues towards cryptos. But the fact that Scheidt said he didn't have anything to do with the projector means that maybe this is just another sculpture that Sanborn did with the code systems that he was taught. Other sculptures that Sanborn has done that have codes on them, they tend to use either Visioneer system or they use binary code. And he tends not to use it, or transposition, and he tends not to use other systems than that. So he tends to, all of his sculptures tend to reuse themes. He quotes from Adam Smith. He loves Indian languages. He likes doing things in other languages, and he likes using the way that light projects. So if he used certain systems on Cryptos, you would think that he would have used those systems in other sculptures that he'd made. And all these sculptures that he's made all use the same systems, which gives us hope that maybe he's used a combination of those systems on Cryptos. But again, we don't know. This is just speculation. So again, this is the Cryptos sculpture. And now we're going into the latitude and longitude. This is an overhead view of CIA headquarters. This is the old headquarters building here. And then they outgrew this and needed a new headquarters building, which they I think they broke ground on this in 1988. And Sanborn was commissioned to make art for it. And he made Cryptos, which is about here in this courtyard. And he also did several other pieces around the CIA complex. He did a landscaped area here, and he did several pieces here around the front entrance area. And here's a close-up here. So again, the old headquarters building is over on this side. This is the new headquarters building here. This white building with the funny-shaped roof is the cafeteria. So Cryptos is here, the sculpture, and Sanborn designed this entire landscaped area. We have a duck pond here, and there's a wall of windows here so that as employees are eating lunch in the cafeteria, they can look through the windows and see the courtyard area. Sanborn also designed several pieces here near the front entranceway. Now, the latitude and longitude, we believe, points to right about here, so about 150 feet south-southeast of the sculpture. When I showed this slide to Sanborn, and I said, here's where we think the latitude and longitude point to, he said, yes, that looks about right. And then he said, it's either there or here. And there's nothing there. The slabs he made are all right along the walkway. There is here, there's another slab he put in which has an engraved compass on it, which is not pointing any place in particular, though we're still trying to get exact readings on that. We know there's a compass there, we've seen a picture of it, but we don't know, does it point exactly this way or does it point exactly that way? And I do have some CIA agents that are trying to help out. There's a hand in the back, yeah.
Have you considered that it might be actually pointing to the Cryptos itself and it's a misspelling leading to this deeper puzzle?
The question was, have we considered that the compass might be pointing towards Cryptos and this may be another...
No, that the latitude
Have we considered that the latitude and longitude may be a typo, and that the typos are a clue for the fact that there's a typo in the latitude and longitude? No, I think that's actually an original idea, and I'll toss that out to the group when we come back. That's an intriguing idea, and it's a good idea, and I like this that you came up with it, because I firmly believe that Cryptos is going to be solved not by some great, cryptological brain, but by someone who comes up with an idea out of left field that fresh eyes. And that's one of the reasons I give these talks. It's not just because it's an interesting story, but I want people to come up at the end of the talk and say, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? Have you thought that maybe the compass is a clock and that you want to look at the way that the sunlight goes through at that time of day? And have you noticed this about a stair step pattern? Or have you noticed that when a Howard Carter, what did you come up with, that the number of steps going down to the tomb was similar to the number of lines? And they're intriguing ideas, and they may have something to do with it. So now Sanborn also said that he had designed the front entrance area to sort of parallel the courtyard area. And he'd originally thought that they were exactly parallel, and then I showed him this slide, and he was like, oh, they're not. And it's been over 10 years since he made it. So it's possible that the location of Kryptos, when he pointed to this area, that he meant that there is a symmetry here, that the latitude and longitude point here, and that maybe the latitude and longitude pointing here is supposed to match something. He wrote about these slabs, that they were a geological seam, the rocks coming up above the ground. And he originally wrote that they were parallel to the building, though in actuality they're perpendicular, but maybe it does need to all be rotated 90 degrees. Again, we don't know. This is all just bits and pieces that he's said and our speculation. These are pictures of some of the slabs. These pictures are courtesy of Jim Galogli, who after he solved the first three parts, actually got an invitation to CIA headquarters and was allowed to take pictures, which we're delighted that he did, because some of these are the only close-up pictures we have of some of these pieces. The Morse code messages say things like SOS, shadow forces, digital interpretatu, T is your position. And as you can see, some of the messages appear to like disappear under the rock. So it's possible that T is your position may be short for what is your position. Also, some of them we don't know which way is right side up. And we've noticed that some of the messages, if you read them one way and then you were to read them upside down and just change the spacing, it would say the same thing. It's like a Morse code palindrome, which again may or may not be important. This is our best picture really of the compass rose. And the north is not pointing to true north, and the needle is not pointing to north. However, the needle is pointing at this rock, which we're pretty sure is a lodestone. Sanborn has made two other pieces that have similar compass roses, and they're both in the DC area. One's in Arlington and one's in Bethesda. And we've tried drawing maps and triangulating which way that the compasses point to and haven't really found anything interesting. But he did have a whole magnetism phase. He loved making things with compass needles pointing in different directions. Other things that have been discovered about part three, one person came up and said, did you know that there's the number, the key for part three is 1473625. We're like, okay. And the way you come up with that in this system is that if you start with number one and number one through four and five through seven, the S comes from number one, the L from four, the O from seven, and it goes through the W from three. And it's the same pattern. So you have the same number key that's repeating over and over. Now, someone else came up and said that the word Kryptos was the same as 1473625, which was really interesting, because we knew that Kryptos was a keyword for part one. We knew that Kryptos was a keyword for part two, but we'd never come up with a way that Kryptos was a keyword for part three until this was discovered last year. Now, how is it equal to the number? Well, David Allen Wilson, who lives in Asheville, North Carolina, came up with this. And he said, you take the letters of Kryptos and you alphabetize them, and then you number them 1 through 7. And then when you spell Kryptos correctly again, you get the number 1473625. And then he said, okay, now I have to go put on my aluminum foil beanie again. And he comes up with some really interesting ideas. He's just constantly throwing ideas at the sculpture. And this is another method that was used for solving Kryptos. This is the mathematical formula. Ferdinando Stele from Italy came up with this, and also two other individuals whose names are escaping me when it was being discussed on the ABC News website. And Gary Warzen from our group has also come up with a double columnar transposition. So lots of different methods for solving this one section. Ed Scheidt again said that he designed it so that it could be solved with multiple different keys. Ed Scheidt has said this was deliberate, that there's so many different methods for solving it. Now, again, I'll point out that these letters are a little bit out of alignment, the Y, A, and the R. Sanborn, when I showed him this slide, he pointed at those and said, has anyone figured anything out about those? They're important. But we don't know why they're important. John Wilson also pointed out that there's additional spaces here. So it's like there's a grouping of five. It's not just that there's three letters that are raised, but slightly indented more than the rest. Yeah, I was the one that discovered the raised letters, and then so lots of different people are discovering different things. We know it's important, but we don't know what it means yet. Roger Anderson from Florida discovered this last year that all of our transcripts were incorrect, and there was an extra letter that was omitted from the original transcripts. The way that the Tableau side, it should be the way it's laid out, every line should end with the same letter. It should go E, F, G, H, I, J, L, M, N, Q, U, V, W, but there are two lines that end with the letter L. And very intriguing, but again, we don't know if it's a clue, if it's important. It's intriguing especially, though, because originally when we counted all the characters on the sculpture, we thought that there were 867 on the cipher side and 864 on the Tableau side, which was just numbers. And then when we add in the L, we get 6765. And then John Wilson pointed out that if you include the two spaces at the beginning and end of the reference alphabets, that you get the same number on each side, 867, 867. And when I showed this slide again, I've shown this presentation to Sanborn, I've showed this presentation to Scheidt. When I got to this section, they were both nodding. They already knew that it was the exact same number of characters on each side. So whether or not it's part of the code or whether it was just some symmetry that they both liked, again, we don't know. I mentioned about this, that the errors are deliberate. On occlusion and underground, there's a typo in the word desperately in part three, slowly, desperately, slowly. And I asked Sanborn if that one was a deliberate error as well. And he gave me a different answer. He said, it's possible. Anything's possible. So that leads me to believe that that was just a screw up on that one. I see a hand in the back. Go back to the picture of the up and down, yes.
Did you notice that, is that key underneath it, or is that R-E-Y?
The question was whether or not this says key or R-E-Y, and it's an R. It is an R.
It
would be... thanks. It's an interesting idea. It's an interesting observation. And now I'm actually going to go back and I'm going to look at the ciphertext and I'm going to look for any other places that it might say key. I see another hand is up.
Well, you mentioned that the typos in the first two were K and R.
Mm-hmm.
Does the A, the typo in part three, the wrong A in desperately, mm-hmm. does that work out to Y?
The question was on the spelling errors in the first two sections where the ciphertext letters were K and R. Does the ciphertext around the spelling and desperately, does it lead to a Y? And to my knowledge, it doesn't. It's a transposition cipher, so it's different.
The character that's there is an L.
John Wilson says the ciphertext character that's there is an L.
And it's on the same line as the additional L on the other side of the Tableau.
And that it's on the same line as the one that has the additional L on the Tableau side. I didn't know about that. Okay,
well,
cool. Okay, so it's being pointed out that the YAR, that there is a Y here, which may tie into the word cryptos, and someone pointed out that the digital interpretatio had a spelling error in it as well. It's also been pointed out that interpretatio, it may just be saying that because it's disappearing under a rock, and we're only getting a partial Morse code, and it should say digital interpretation.
Well, digital is misspelled.
Digital is misspelled, right. It's got an E instead of an I. Now, in Morse code, an I is two dots, and an E is one dot. So what we have is a single missing dot in that.
And there are two dots.
And there are two dots on the untitled cryptos piece.
The
and then there's a Cyrillic projector with a bolt on the inside, which is sort of like a dot. So yeah, there's lots of intriguing things here. Yeah. Okay. How am I doing on time? Okay, we're doing good. Yeah, I've got another 20 minutes, right? Or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, just barely.
Okay. We're fine. Okay, and as for those of you who hadn't seen, this is another discovery that John Wilson made when he went back and went and examined the Cyrillic projector on the campus at University of North Carolina, Charlotte, is that the plates are bolted together with bolts that are a certain distance apart. However, there is one place where there's an additional bolt. It's flush on the outside. You can't really see it, but on the inside, It's very clear, and it is the only bolt of that type in the entire sculpture. And it is on the same line as one of the key words for solving the sculpture, which is the word Medusa. Actually, we needed the Russian spelling of the word, which is Medusa. And so it might have been a clue or a hint. So again, we're trying to get people who are at CIA to go in and take a really closer look at the sculpture there to see if maybe there's an extra bolt or a scratch or something. Remember, Kryptos was not designed as a puzzle to be solved by the general public. It was designed as a challenge for the employees who were at the agency. When I asked Sanborn if it could be solved, Part 4 could be solved, he said, yes, it ain't easy, but it's solvable. But let me just say this, if you can solve it, we all should be worried. And does that mean that you have to be on grounds to solve it? Does that mean that it's just really, really hard? Again, I don't know. But it was a very interesting thing for him to be saying. Here's the reference spaces that we were talking about. If you add these two spaces in, then you get the exact same number of characters on either side of the sculpture. This is one of my own pet theories, is that perhaps the reason that the sculpture is in this sort of S shape is that it's a taken apart cylinder. And Sanborn has said, and Scheidt has said, that they wanted to use historical systems of cryptography. And one various system was designed by Thomas Jefferson, where you would make a cylinder, and each cylinder, or each disk in the cylinder would have a series of letters in it. And then you could reorder these disks by any different pattern that you wanted. And Thomas Jefferson uses quite extensively. The Army has also used it. They've got a system, they don't call it the Thomas Jefferson cylinder, they call it the M94 cipher system. And John Wilson has also pointed out that that number 94 has also, if you count the letters of Part 4 in a certain way, the 94th letter is the letter M, which, and there's only one M in all of Part 4, which may be coincidence, maybe not. We don't know. Right. Another thing that John Wilson discovered is that the cipher M94 cylinder came into use in 1922, and Howard Carter's diary extract was from November 26, 1922. Lots of coincidences there. So looking at Part 4 again, we also have here where we have, if you take the right-hand letters here, we have a KR, we have a YP, and SO or an OS and a T over here, so you have all the letters of Kryptos that are kind of next to each other. This may tie into the palimpsest keyword, where you have one scroll, where you have one message showing through. Maybe this is showing that it's showing through from the tableau of the other side. Again, we don't know, it's just an interesting observation. Someone else pointed out that if you take all of Part 4 and you line it up into 7-letter rows, and then you count the doubled letter pairs, there are exactly 6 doubled letter pairs. 5 of those double letter pairs are directly underneath each other in the same column. The chance of there being 6 double letter pairs isn't that exciting. The statistics say the chances are about 1 in 3 that there would be 6 pairs. The chances that 5 of those would be in the same column is very rare. Then it becomes more like 1 in 1,000, so it's more statistically significant. And then we have the SS and the subtle shading, yeah, which again, yeah, maybe, maybe not. Also, the fact that it is 7 letters is interesting, because if Kryptos is a keyword for Part 1 and Part 2 and Part 3, chances are pretty good that it's also a keyword for Part 4. So anything that would use the number 7 would be intriguing. This is Ed Scheidt. He's the man who taught the encryption systems to Sanborn. One person in my other talk asked, who really did the encryption? Was it Ed or was it Jim? And the answer is, we're not really sure. Each of them individually has said that they created the code on Kryptos. Sanborn is adamant that he did it on a long drive when he was driving the petrified wood back to the East Coast, and that's when he did the encryption, and he did it on his own. Scheidt has said that he did it. My speculation is that Scheidt did it via a workbook system, that he made certain worksheets which he gave to Sanborn, and then Sanborn used those worksheets, and that perhaps we need to recreate those worksheets and figure out, because Sanborn has said that as an artist, he thought that the fourth section would be fairly easy to solve. So it's possible that he took the worksheet and drew a spiral or some design on it that we can't duplicate because we don't know what the worksheet looked like. But again, this is just speculation on my part. Both of them loved Egypt stuff. Ed used to like wearing ties with hieroglyphic patterns. Sanborn was intrigued by the Howard Carter quote. It was a quote that had inspired him since he was a kid. And Sanborn also attended Oxford University, which is where Howard Carter attended, and that's where Howard Carter's diaries are, at Oxford University. So there's all these patterns and coincidences which may or may not be useful. Okay, also, Ed Scheidt, when I spoke to him, he was very interested in seeing me get access to CIA again. I was invited there once to speak about Al-Qaeda codes, and he was curious if I would get access again. And I told him it's very difficult to get into CIA. You tend to get, if you just drive up and ask for a tour, you get turned away by large men with guns. And I was very fortunate to get my one invitation. And I told him I'd try to get another invite, and he said, well, if you can't, let me know. And my understanding was that he would see if he could pull some strings that would get me a speaking invite. Well, I tried to pull all my strings, and they all broke, and couldn't get an invite, and I finally sent an email to Ed and said, I've tried everything I can't get in. And I didn't hear back from him right away, but about 3 hours later, I got this IM from someone named Molly H. And IM was one sentence: the key to cryptos is komitet. And I wrote back and I said, oh, and I didn't get any reply. And then I wrote back and they'd logged off. And, you know, komitet is the K in KGB. Most people don't know what komitet stands for. It's the word committee. And Molly Hale is a woman who works at CIA headquarters in the Public Affairs Department. If you write to CIA and say, I'd like a tour, and they write back and they say no, the letter will probably be signed by a woman named Molly Hale. And all very interesting coincidences. I do get a lot of strange emails and IMs about cryptos. I have people who write to me and say that they've solved the code and it's proof that space aliens control the United States government. But generally people don't do this anonymously, or if they do it anonymously, the one other anonymous message was the one from the guy who said he solved the Cyrillic projector, and he really had sort of solved the Cyrillic projector. And also, generally people who send me messages, they want to correspond with me. They want to get a back and forth. It was another interesting thing about the line is that they said the key to cryptos is komitet. Every time I talked to Ed, he would always talk about the keys. You've solved parts 1 through 3 without recovering the keys first. You need to recover the keys, and then part 4 will become, I think he said part 4 would fall into place, which we still don't know what that means. But it sounds like Ed, but it might have just been a hoax. Also, komitet has 7 letters, which is another intriguing thing. Komitet, here from that classified KGB correspondence, you can see here, komitet. So was it a hoax or was it a hint? We don't know. Whoever did send it to me, well, they knew I was working on cryptos, which is pretty obvious. Question in the back.
The key to cryptos is komitet,
mm-hmm.
which is the K in KGB. Well, central is a 7-letter word. There's a 7-letter word. The first letter is CIA, which is the alternate antagonist.
That's another original idea. What someone came up with is that komitet is the K in KGB, and it has 7 letters. CIA is Central Intelligence Agency, and the word central has 7 letters. So maybe we should be looking at the word central as a keyword. And John Wilson's nodding too, right?
C, not a K.
And it starts with a C and not a K. Yeah. So I'm...
The correct spelling of cryptos in English? Mm-hmm.
Well, cryptos is cryptos is actually a Greek word, which does start with the letter K. It means hidden. Okay.
Central is also sortable to turn into a sequence of 1 to 7, like cryptos is. All 7 letters are different. Unlike komitet, there's 2 letters are the same, so it wouldn't be a key. But every word in central is 7 different letters, so it could be sorted and come up with a numeric key from that.
That's an intriguing. Randall Schwartz has come up with the observation that komitet has a doubled letter in it, so isn't as useful if you want to number the letters alphabetically, but central would be useful because all of the letters are different. John and I are going to be playing with this later today. Okay. All right, these are all, I was going to go over more about the hint or hoax, but I'll just run through these. Whoever did send it to me, they obviously knew something about crypto. They knew some Cold War history. Komitet is not a word in common usage, and they did send a 7-letter key. So I'm distracted now because I'm thinking about the word central. I think this is possibly a very interesting lead. Another thing that we're checking is other artwork that Sanborn has done. He designed the interior decorations of this restaurant, the Zola Spy Restaurant in Washington, D.C. One entire wall here is covered with classified documents, I assume declassified documents, in English, French, and Russian. And we know that at least one of these documents was one of the source documents for the Cyrillic projector. So if Sanborn used every document he had for this wall, and some of the documents are duplicated there, and one of the documents is the source for the projector, one of these documents might also be source for Kryptos or for other sculptures that he's done. So we're people are sending me photographs of these, trying to get close-ups, and we're trying to get all of these transcribed. And I don't have sound, so I'll skip that. So, summary. There are many world-famous unsolved codes. Some of them may have been hoaxes and are never solvable, but the quest for solving them is still a useful endeavor. Some of them have been solved. Some of them have been solved after 100 years of trying. Also, it's important to keep in mind that code makers make mistakes. If something's unsolvable, it's possible that the person who created it introduced errors, which have made it harder. So the code solver is behooved to keep that in mind and to try different ways of doing things. Don't assume that the code maker was perfect. Also, in solving a code, it's important to think that small patterns can solve the large puzzle. Don't look at a code and think, gah, I got to solve the entire thing at once. Look for little things. Look for the word the. Do frequency analysis. That's the first thing I always do when I'm solving a code, is I do a frequency analysis. But the important thing is to try. Don't be intimidated by it. Just try and share information. Many things were slowed down because one person would have one piece and another person would have another piece, and if they just would have talked to each other, things would have gone much faster. So that's one of the reasons that I give these talks. People ask me if I have a lot of ego wrapped up in solving Kryptos, and I'm like, I don't have to be the person that solves it. I want to see it solved. So if that means that I can help see it solved by shoveling information at people that are smarter than I am, who may be able to come up with things that I haven't seen, I'm all for it. I just want to get it off my plate, and I want to see the thing finally done. So for more information, you can write to me, ilonka@aol.com. My URL is there, ilonka.com, or just go to Google and type in famous unsolved codes. If you want to read a book about codes, the number one book I recommend is one written by Simon Singh called The Code Book. This is an excellent, excellent overview of code systems. It's a really interesting read. If you want to get deeper into it, a really well-recommended book is by Helen Fouché-Gaines called Cryptanalysis. And this is sort of a collection of essays from a crypto discussion group from about 100 years ago or so, and many of the information here is still very useful. She also has frequency analysis tables in English and French and other languages, and there's a lot of good data in this book. And Q&A, I wanted to cover the World War II question. The Enigma ciphers have been cracked, the Enigma machine. However, there's certain Enigma messages that still haven't been cracked. There's also various systems that were designed for a temporary purpose, and we still don't know what they say, but they're kept in various historical archives here and there. World War II code was huge in World War II. Cracking the Enigma cipher definitely changed the course of the war. The Zimmerman telegram kind of got us into the war, which was a code that was being sent trying to encourage Mexico to get involved in things, as I recall. Yeah. Scott has a question.
Pull the mic if it works. Okay. Yeah, I wanted to ask if has there been any fallout, because the Kryptos has been solved, at least parts of it have been solved by non-CIA employees, since it was designed for CIA employees. Are you aware of any fallout?
Has there been any fallout? I have not been the recipient of any kind of negative attention from CIA. Every time I give a talk, I tend to... That I know of, right? When I'm going to give this talk and I have these overhead views of CIA headquarters, and I'll write to one of my CIA contacts and say, I'm going to give a talk with pictures of overhead views of CIA headquarters. Is it okay? And they generally write back and say, Ilonka, you don't work at CIA. Because you don't work at CIA, you can say anything you want about CIA. I have not signed anything saying that I'm not going to be speaking. Someone who works at CIA, they're limited in terms of what they can say and what kind of information that they can present. The folks that I've talked to at CIA, I generally see CIA as not this super secret organization, but more like a university campus. There's many thousands of people there. Not everyone knows everything that everyone else knows. And they're An academic endeavor is really kind of a good way of describing it. There's people there that are trying to learn as much as they can, often as quickly as they can. They're very motivated because they're conscious if they don't learn it quickly that people could die in their own country. And so they're all the people that I've met at CIA were very, very motivated to protect the United States. That was a huge priority for them. Any other questions? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever ask, because you mentioned this in your talk earlier, that maybe there was some kind of play with light or something like that, that it might be solved the way light comes through or something like that. Do you ask whether or not it can be solved
on the independently owned piece and whether in where it sits right now? Because if he says, well, it probably can't be solved anymore, then you know that it had something to do with the interplay of light or shadows or something like that. Whereas if he says, no, it can still be solved, then you can pretty much put all the light shadow concept to the side and try working on it in different.
I haven't asked Sanborn if the untitled Kryptos piece could be solved in situ, where it is with the way that the light is. I did ask him and Scheidt if Kryptos could be solved by people who were not at CIA. I told them that on my Kryptos website I used the analogy of a kitchen. And I said, sort of like the Iron Chef, if someone comes in, I don't know what they're going to be cooking, but they're going to, I want all the ingredients and all the pots and pans there so that anything they reach for is there. I said, is my site an adequately stocked kitchen so that someone from Australia could log on, look at the info in my site, and solve Kryptos? And the specific question I asked Ed Scheidt was, could someone solve Kryptos based on the information that's available by looking at the code and looking at the pictures of the sculpture? And Scheidt gave a really interesting reaction. He got really quiet for about a minute, and he was thinking about it, and he was thinking about it, and he's thinking about it. And then he gave me this really sly look and said, I'll have to leave that open. So I don't know if he's thinking about what he is or is not allowed to say because of his involvement with the CIA or the way I'd phrase the question. Sanborn does love playing with light. He absolutely does love playing with light. And there's several other differences in the untitled piece. The raised letters are not there, the YAR raised letters. The sequence of code systems on Kryptos, it's sections 1, 2, 3, and 4. We've numbered them 1 through 4 because that's where they are in Kryptos. There's no number on the sculpture. On the untitled piece, they're more like 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, and a half, a 4 or something. It repeats, but it starts with section number 3. And there's also an extra space at one section where it does repeat. At one spot, there's a space separating the code sections, and the other, it's just all mushed together. Sorry?
Between 4 and 1.
Between 4 and 1, right.
But at the second repeat, it doesn't.
Yeah, so the first repeat, there's a space. The second repeat, there's not a space. Don't know why. Any other questions? Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you all very much for coming.